Stories for August 11th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
Friendship has some flow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And look at us. Look at us! Episode 124 of Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, because we discussed the entire canon of Sherlock Holmes for 123 days in a row. And now that we're done with that entire canon, now we're moving on to our next book.
So, Pam, do you think that we could become Sherlock Holmes in this story?
Oh, definitely. I think we will become Sherlock Holmes.
As long as we don't become H.H. Holmes, I think we'll be all right. That's a different concept here. We are beginning our discussion today of the 2003 novel Devil in the White City by Eric Larson.
Is it a novel, Steve?
Oh, boy.
It's so easy to call it a novel, right?
You are right.
But this book is technically a work of nonfiction, even though it is set up as a novel. And I bet there are people who read it thinking it was a novel, even though he states really clearly from the beginning that this is a work of nonfiction. And in fact, it fits under the general title of true crime.
After reading all the Sherlock Holmes stories, this is certainly much gorier than what we were dealing with. But there's this part of this that is set up just like a story that, you know, isn't real. Unfortunately, it is.
And I was one of those people that the first time I read this, I was convinced that this was just a backdrop for a fiction. I knew that the World's Fair in Chicago was the pinnacle, the centerpiece, the pivoting moment on so much technology. And then this silly author wrote this silly serial killer story set in this historic place. I was one of those people that did not know this was fully a nonfiction work.
Well, and it's really interesting to take this moment where you do have this rather famous serial killer, who, by the way, I didn't know very much about either, and to really set it up so that a reader could imagine it as a work of fiction. And I guess I was kind of curious to ask you guys, I must admit, I'm not a big true crime reader. And I do wonder how you guys feel about sort of the ethics of true crime. You know, what's at stake when you take a story of true crime and you actually sort of sell it or commodify it in this narrative structure that feels like detective fiction, which is one of the most popular genres in the world?
Well, I think that you're documenting something that was from a long time ago. So it is not necessarily something that you're looking at today. We don't always have perfect information of that. But you've got the backdrop of the Chicago World's Fair and all that's going on. We've got a person who is ultimately taking advantage of that situation and has a history, as we're going to learn, of taking advantage of a lot of situations. And it wasn't that it just happened. It's that he planned for this to happen. And there's the real horror that comes into it. So when we talk about the ethics of it, It's one of those things where I think that's a real question, is that if you are creating celebrity out of people who do heinous crimes, that's awful. But I think we've got enough time between us and this story that, from when this was established, I think it's a fascinating story of how many people and sort of how the circumstances allowed something like this to happen where it's unlikely to happen in our current society. Although, you know, all you have to do is pick up the news and you can see unique situations. Let's just call them unique situations that have gone on and people just overlook them.
So I think you've brought up two super interesting things there, Chip. One is the amount of time that has passed since the event, right? I think you're totally right that there's a totally different moral or ethical framework to writing a true crime story that happened in 2010 versus one that happened in 1893, right? So because, you know, with contemporary true crime, I mean, people's families are still alive. You know, there's something really unsettling about the notion of telling people's very, very personal, traumatic, horrifying stories when families are still alive. And then the other thing I think you bring up super interesting is that notion of creating a celebrity of a serial killer, right? And that's something that the media thinks about all the time. How many times do you say the name of a mass or serial killer in the coverage of events? And it's a huge question mark. I mean, we're not going to solve that here, but I think it is, to me, those two ethical questions are in the backdrop as I'm reading this book for the first time. And I wanted to ask you guys, so have you read this book before? I know, Steve, you have.
Correct.
I have not read this book. Okay. This is one of those books that, you know, we all have these books that we want to get through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't done it. You know, we haven't sat down and really read it because life.
It just didn't come to the top of my to-read list either. So, sure. So this is exciting. So, Steve, you can lead us through this because we're new to this book. We've only read the first part right now, so...
I think we've chosen the right book. Several of our listeners have read this before, and they were very happy to hear that we were going to read this particular book because they enjoyed the narrative of this one. Christine and Elizabeth Ferries, who is one of our executive producers, Sally, Diane, and Chris, and... my friend Matt said he actually started reading this book last week, so he's going to be reading along with us. So we've got some listeners who have endorsed this book as the right book to do for our next read.
So if you are a listener that is listening to this on a weekly basis with us as we're recording this, you have the ability to enjoy this, and you can send questions in, and you can be part of this discussion.
Oh, yeah. There are plenty of people who are excited about this discussion. Magda, our mutual friend Magda, is one of those who is picking up this book to have this discussion. This is the book club we've always wanted to be a part of. Back to your question about entertainment and true crime. I have a real hard time finding entertainment in real events. I don't watch any of the September 11th movies. I will never find joy or entertainment in the pain of that moment. It's too close to my own existence. I have a hard time with any of the stories told about the Holocaust. Those stories are too close to my personal history. So a book like this that is presented as entertainment, that the author is making money on the heels of this pain that was caused by this serial killer. I agree with you. It is kind of a challenge to separate those ideas. So let's talk about this narrative structure for a second. The idea of Eric Larson's storytelling here, this seems like a work of nonfiction. He actually gives us this sentence at the beginning. However strange or macabre some of the following incidents may seem, this is not a work of fiction. Anything between quotation marks comes from a letter, memoir, or other written document. This is real story told with real evidence, but he's so good at giving us an emotional reasoning behind these quotations that he's giving us.
And it reminds me of a really good biography, since quite a lot of it is character development, where the biographer does this wonderful job of imagining, you know, what of setting the scene, of imagining what things might have been like, and then also pulls back to give us documentation.
And I find it so intriguing that he decides not to tell this story in chronological order, that we get the information as it's necessary for the narrative here, which is something that a good biography does, and something that, boy, the biographies that I don't enjoy are just a chronology. This happened, and then this happened. Mm-hmm.
The writer's playing here in a skillful way. Because he recognizes this, there's a lot, as you get involved in this story, the first 10 chapters we're discussing today, you're being drawn in. There's three or four different narratives going on. You're getting a lot on the background of what's going on in Chicago at the time and in the world in general at the time. You're getting a background of, you know, of how they're going to put on this grand event and who they're hiring and how they're putting together the deals that make it happen. And then you got this third guy who is our serial killer, who is just, we're getting the background of his life to get him to set up, which my assumption is the second part of this book is going to get pretty gruesome.
And it's so interesting that in this first part, the first 10 chapters, the author switches between our two main characters, Daniel Burnham and this serial killer, H.H. Holmes, as he called himself. And that's so intriguing for storytelling, to see something happening historically from one perspective and then to switch to a different scene. That's good storytelling.
How is this not a miniseries on Netflix or a movie? This is excellent.
It has been optioned by one Leonardo DiCaprio.
Interesting.
He has a contract with Hulu to bring this to Hulu with director Martin Scorsese.
Okay.
This obviously, then we picked the right book.
This is ripe. This is ripe for that sort of storytelling, for sure.
And I think it's really interesting that he really, from the beginning, sets up a lot of similarities between Daniel Burnham and H.H. Holmes. They're both young. They're both handsome. They both have piercing blue eyes. And there's this great quote, "The eyes are very big and wide open." A physician named John L. Capon later observed, "They are blue. Great murderers, like great men in other walks of activity, have blue eyes." I'm like, wow, that's a very interesting ethnographic statement. But anyway, we won't get into that. But he really does set up a lot of similarities between these two men who have a very competitive streak, who are very charismatic, and who are to become very central to this moment. And I just would note that it's in the 1890s, we have this total meta narrative of progress, right? So we've just spent the past 123 days in England looking at Sherlock Holmes and the various kinds of notions of progress that worked through the Victorian age and into the early 20th century. We're seeing the exact same thing here. Chicago is a crazy city. There's lots of fascinating things happening, but there's this notion that, like, with American industry, you can create this amazing fair in no time flat that's going to be way better than what they're doing in Europe. There's this competitive piece, this industrial piece, and there's a fascinating energy to the serial killer and the architect that's sort of shared between them.
Daniel Burnham certainly is a figure in Chicago. We know that name historically because of this undertaking, this amazing, in no time, huge fair. And we see some of the struggles in the beginning of this story, where he is the central figure to bring the World's Columbian Exposition to Chicago in 1893. But the author brings us forward first. The beginning of this book takes place aboard the RMS Olympic on April 14th, 1912.
That's a large ship, right, Steve?
Yeah. It is a very large ship, and that date looms very large as well. That's the date that the sister ship to the RMS Olympic sank. Its name, the Titanic.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, and this is a super fascinating narrative strategy, right? So when you use a famous date like that, and, you know, a number of writers in the 21st century have started novels on September 11th, 2001, and as a reader, you think, oh no, I know what's going to happen, but the characters in the book have no idea what's going to happen. And so I just kind of wanted to ask you guys, as you read that, April 14th, 1912, what was the impact of that on you as a reader? This notion of, like, sort of playing with temporality where you actually have information the characters don't have.
Well, Well, in fact, reading this entire book, I've got information that is not being presented. I mean, as you're reading the book, I'm trying to, all right, so the Civil War ended in 1865. Okay, what's going on in Chicago? You're trying to think of how the America is coming together at this time, and you need to like really come to accept that the world that you're currently living in your community in the United States certainly is being developed at that time. It isn't even there yet. And I ultimately, when I'm reading something like this, I'm just trying to picture what else is going on in the world. And the idea that we're on the sister ship to the Titanic, it is the day that it sank, is important. I mean, it basically sets the period. We're on something that is not supposed to sink. We're on, the world is going forward. We're in a world of progress. Bad things are a thing of the past. We are in the future. Look at how special we are. And anyway, other things are going on.
So I would say I love that, Chip. And it feels like the author is inviting us as readers to really historicize the moment, right? And so by moving forward 20 years to 1912 from the fair in 1893, he's reminding us, hey, you guys know a lot of stuff that the characters don't know. And so you can go ahead and historicize that. This also brings me to a notion that comes from Anne Kaplan, a cultural theorist. She's been writing lately. She writes in trauma theory. She's been writing about pre-trauma. This notion that specifically she studies climate change. This notion that, like, we know there's a big trauma coming regarding climate, but we're not there yet. And so we are living in this pre-trauma moment. And narratively, the notion of pre-trauma is present in many novels. And this is a great example where we know a trauma is coming that the characters don't. So we are from the future seeing that, but we're also in a moment in our own lives in 2020 where we can see traumas coming in our future and we don't know how we're going to handle them. So there's something, or like, there's something cool about fiction slash nonfiction and pre and post trauma happening at the same time here.
It's such good writing. It is such a great shorthand for a lot of emotions that are stuck to that date and to that moment. We all know about the Titanic. We might not be able to name another ship that sank, but we know that one. And using that as our signpost for this is what to prepare for is that's amazing writing. The World's Columbian Exposition, which took place in 1893 in Chicago, was the celebration of the 400-year anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of the New World. So it should have been 1892, 400 years after 1492, but they needed the extra year because of all of the huge plans that they made for this fair.
And think about the sort of the American zeitgeist at the time. The United States is trying to define itself in a history. The old world, which we would consider Europe, has this rich history. It goes on and on and on in the past. But for the United States, we're kind of defining our I shouldn't call them half truths, but sort of, oh, Christopher Columbus. Oh yeah, we're going to grab on to them because he's discovered the New World, and we are part of the New World at this time. Now, and what's so fascinating about it is just within a month ago, in Baltimore, they grabbed the Christopher Columbus statue and they threw it into the harbor. So we certainly are at a different world than we were at that time. But countries at the time were thought to want to have a narrative to them, and Christopher Columbus was definitely part of the United States narrative, and wanted to be part of the United States narrative at the time.
And some of the other historical narrative parts here are the World's Fair in Paris took place in 1889, and a lot of the conversation in the first 10 chapters is talking about trying to best that World's Fair. The World's Fair where the Eiffel Tower was constructed is a conversation that's had so many times in this part.
And this reminds me so much of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle writing this difference between America in Europe, right? This super competitive feeling between the two continents.
And Chicago wants to establish itself. It's so important that they do. This is very similar to the founding of your country when Thomas Jefferson, basically a person who during the entire Revolutionary War spent his time in Paris, and he learned the wine of the time. He learned the fabrics of the time. He basically soaked up the culture so that when diplomats or people came to visit Washington or New York City at the time, and they were going to be dined and they were going to be told what's going on with the opportunities available in the United States, that the leaders of the United States could come across as the civilized group of the time. Paris, you know, probably the world city of the time, you know, London could argue. But certainly they're arguing over, like, oh, are we part of the modern culture? Of course we are. The United States, we've got the wines you need. We've got the types of food and how to prepare it and all those other things available to you. And plus we have all this land.
And Chicago is trying to establish itself as the place to be. This is right after the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. This was a huge moment in Chicago history. The whole place burned down, and they were able to decide how they were going to rebuild. They decided on the system of streets, a grid system, as opposed to New York and, God forbid, Boston, where the streets are just a snake pit of roads that people used at a different time. Chicago had the opportunity, and they took it.
And certainly, they are the planned city. And for any person who has said, I'm afraid of visiting a large city, Chicago is like the biggest small town in the world because of this grid system that was established. It is very easy to use the roads and figure out where you need to go. And I'm going to briefly just touch on this. The Great Chicago Fire was October 8th, 1871. Let's see, 300 people died, and it destroyed 3.3 square miles, but had over 100,000 residents homeless. So they were rebuilding from that. And, you know, we're less, what are we, 22 years later? And Chicago has annexed enough land that they've overtaken Philadelphia to be the second largest city in the United States. But I also wanted to mention two things that you may not be aware of. Pam, were you aware of the Peshtigo Fire in Wisconsin, in the upper part of Wisconsin? That also took place April 8th, 1871, the same day. Wow. They don't even know how many people died, because you have to recognize newspapers. And, we don't have the connection that we have today, because these were, you know, little house on the prairie type times. Mm-hmm. And they had 1.2 million acres were burned at the time. They think between 1,500 and 2,500 people died during that period of time. They were standing in the water trying to get to, you know, whatever water was there so they wouldn't die. And at the same time, the Hand, Michigan, also had a fire on that same date. And there's a lot of speculation on what could cause that. We're still trying to figure out, and we may never truly be able to determine what that was. But they had a lot of towns wiped out in Michigan, same date. They think it may have been a meteor shower. So a meteor shower may have landed in Chicago and Wisconsin and Michigan and given us this crazy event. So anyway, a little speculation and a little past putting that in the history for us.
Interesting. There's so much history involved in this history book that, again, just seems like a great narrative. We get all sorts of the background behind this idea of this great fair, this huge World's Fair, which, again, is pivotal to all of the development of technology after this. We'll get to, in subsequent chapters, all of the different things that came into being because of this World's Fair. But at the beginning, we are here with Daniel Burnham, who is just a young, amazing architect who needs to put together this giant thing. And then on alternate chapters, we have this serial killer who's putting together his own plan.
our serial killer, we know him as H.H. Holmes. Now, before we are introduced to him, it sounds like he had a number of different names. And he certainly had a history of scheming and just trying to establish himself. What we know about him is he's smart, he's charming, and he certainly knows how to take advantage of the situation. All right, so we have the birth of the term psychopath. The person who coined that term was a person named Cleckley. This is a person who is who can outwardly a perfect mimic of a normally functioning person, and he's able to mask and disguise the fundamental lack of this personality disorder. And ultimately, what do we know about Holmes? He's charming, he's very bright, he's a schemer, and he's trying to outsmart the system during this period of time. And there are all sorts of examples of him doing this. One was when he was in school, and he spent the summer in Michigan, and he spent the summer in northern Illinois selling books. He sold the books, never turned in the money to pay for them. You know, other examples are he built a building that had a pharmacy in it. He's going to build one across the street. He tells the person he's selling the pharmacy to is like, no, oh, there's no competition for him. Across the street, he opens a pharmacy to compete with him. He's always in debt. He's always, as the debt collectors come in to collect those debts, he has devised a fake person who owns companies. He's devised a way to be able to charm the people. In fact, I think it was described, he brings out drinks and cigars and they have dinner, and the people leave with a joke in their hands. They feel good, but they're not collecting. And even one time furniture was brought to the restaurant, and as the collector came to get paid, he was sent away only to have the next day the furniture goes away.
No collection is made.
Yeah, no collection is made. This man was making money, but he also wasn't paying any of his debts either. Mm-hmm. So this is certainly a person who we're going to keep an eye on, because there are so many unique and strange things going on in the building of what will become this horror house across the street.
And I love Eric Larson's description of Holmes here. Holmes was charming and gracious, but something about him made people uneasy. He could, this was one specific character named Belknap, said that he could not have defined it. Indeed, for the next several decades, alienists and their successors would find themselves hard-pressed to describe with any precision what it was about men like Holmes that could cause them to seem warm and ingratiating, but also telegraph the vague sense that some important element of humanness was missing. An alienist, by the way, is an old-timey term for psychiatrist or psychologist. In 1885, the lay press got hold of the word psychopath. William Stead's Pall Mall Gazette described it as a new malady and stated, beside his own person and his own interests, nothing is sacred to the psychopath. We have here a man who is the definition of that term.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually think that Larson sets it up super nicely by starting with the issue of disappearance. So even before we meet our psychopath, and who's presented as such, when we open this book to chapter one, The Black City, it opens with how easy it was to disappear. It's a great opening line. You know, openings, but it's a great opening line that goes on to discuss, and it's brought up several times, that in this huge urban center of Chicago, which is very, very bustling and busy and malodorous and has a lot going on, you have people disappearing all the time. And one of the great quotations, it's a little further on, vanishment seemed a Chicago pastime. There were too many disappearances in all parts of the city to investigate properly, and too many forces impeding the detection of patterns. Patrolmen, many of them, were barely competent, appointed solely at the direction of ward bosses. Detectives were few, their resources and skills minimal. Class obscured their vision. Ordinary vanishings, Polish girls, stockyard boys, Italian laborers, Negro women, merited little effort. So this notion that in the big urban city, and there's this late 19th century concern about urbanization that we just saw in Sherlock Holmes, we have this idea that people can come to the city and disappear. And unless they're like wealthy white girls, no one's going to pay attention.
I'm not even sure if it's girls. I think it's just wealthy white men.
Okay, you're right. Wealthy white people. Yeah. So I find it really fascinating that he sets up that context of a lot of people disappear in this town and the police are 100% not set up to deal with it before introducing us to the psychopath.
Who is making people disappear.
And I think this captures it real well. So if you are a person, listen, just think of any person who would choose to go to not Philadelphia, not New York. So you've already, let's just say you're an immigrant or you're a poor person, you've made your way to Chicago somehow. You could disappear and nobody, there's no family. There's no one knows that you're gone. You're just gone. You were renting a room or you were in a room or something like that for a week or two or three or whatever it was, and now you're no longer there. In addition to that, you know, what we learned from H.H. Holmes is that you can change who you are as you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So you could start off as one name and all of a sudden you're a new person when you come to the area. So all the past is lost.
And to that point about Chicago and the urbanization of the nation at that point, Eric Larson does mention Upton Sinclair's The Jungle from 1906, talking about those slaughterhouses that Chicago was very well known for.
Well, and that was a reference I was kind of expecting, in that I just, you know, you think of Chicago, you think of Carl Sandburg for me, who's much later, and then Upton Sinclair. But there was another reference right after that one that I wasn't expecting, which I thought was super effective. At the end of chapter two, he ends with just, he loves the single line paragraph, which I do too. Only Poe could have dreamed the rest. Now, this is clearly not a Chicago reference, but a Baltimore one. But I feel like Chicago and Baltimore in the public imagination sort of have some things in common.
They do.
You know, being big cities with really high homicide rates, which is something that he actually talks about, the homicide rate in Chicago. But also this notion that, like, you've got to go to Edgar Allan Poe, the founder of horror fiction, for inspiration for this true story that he's about to tell us. He does really well with playing with temporality and with raising the reader's expectations.
And we have the historical piece of Jack the Ripper that was also happening at about the same time in London.
May I ask you, fine gentlemen, did you think that level of detail about Jack the Ripper and his crimes was just what you were hoping for?
I agree with you. It's a little shiver-inducing, but it goes to the point of, this is what serial killers look like. So far, our serial killer in this story is not gruesomely making people disappear. They are just disappearing. But the gruesome factor of Jack the Ripper was there.
So I've got a question about Holmes. Did Holmes ultimately get away with this? Or was he caught?
I guess we'll find out. I guess we'll find out
is why we're reading the book, Chip. You didn't ask that question.
This is history. But Jack the Ripper got away.
May I suggest you do not turn to the last page of this book? Come on, good reader.
Book club. This is a book club. Read along with us, everybody.
Don't look it up on Wikipedia. Chip is just about to look it up on Wikipedia. I can feel it. Anyway, but no, so Jack the Ripper is, like, obviously this super fascinating figure in 1880s England, and he becomes it's the first serial killer celebrity, right? And it's true that the fact that we still don't to this day know who Jack the Ripper was, and people, including crime writer Patricia Cornwell, still put out books all the time making arguments for, was this person. I mean, this is something, let's face it, we're never going to know who Jack the Ripper was, right? I would say. But either way, people love to imagine that we will figure it out. It speaks to us as readers/investigators, but It also speaks to the fact, and Larson mentions this, that people in London as well as in the US were absolutely fascinated with this terrifying notion, again linked to anxieties about urbanization, but also anxieties about women's sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes specifically. Now, I'm getting the feeling that H.H. Holmes is a little more broad in his tastes, but I guess we will find out more. But this notion that women could go to the city and disappear and no one would even really notice the pattern, let alone be able to solve the mystery, it's a terrifying notion. And it's linked to that first wave of feminism that's happening at this exact moment, where women want to have much, much more freedom. Women want to be treated as equal. Women want to not be chaperoned at all times. And this narrative of like, there's a boogeyman who's going to kill you if you ride your own bicycle and make your own money and own your own property. Because let's face it, Jack the Ripper killed 5 prostitutes. And there's a possibility that there were more. There's lots and lots. But they call it the canon, which I find troubling. The canon of 5. But either way, you know, most women are not, most new women of the 1890s are not in fact killed by serial killers. But when you hear about the anxieties of the city, that's what comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it was only 5. That this man, right, the embodiment of evil, and I love the way that Eric Larson writes this, I'm paraphrasing, but 5 confirmed victims, only 5, and Jack the Ripper became the embodiment forever of pure evil. When we think of serial killers, Jack the Ripper is one of the names that comes up. I don't know that H.H. Holmes is.
I was passingly aware, but I wasn't even aware of, you know, all the horror he did. But part of it is London is a major city at the time. It is a world, if not the world city. I said Paris was, mm-hmm. but London could argue that they are. In addition to that, the newspapers, the tabloids at the time certainly created this monster as much as, you know, he was a monster. So it became so much more. It wasn't just that Jack the Ripper killed people. It was that it was sensationalized in the newspaper, created panic and fear in the community with that.
And provided the kind of details, which Larson shared with us, which I'm not going to get into, but the kind of details, sensational, salacious details, that people really were both attracted to and repelled by, which is what made them so powerful.
Mm-hmm. But there's always helpers. We can always find the helpers. And in this story, we have detectives, Pam. Your favorite kind of detectives.
Always watching.
Oh, thanks for lobbing that one at me. Because of course, you know, as someone who studies detective fiction rather than true crime, I'm always excited when detectives get mentioned. But this is pretty funny. In the most transcendent moment, Larson writes, it was easy to make a mistake and forget some little thing that a clever detective might eventually use to propel him to the gallows. Him being Holmes. Whether the Chicago police even possessed that kind of talent was open to question. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency was the more dangerous entity, but its operatives of late seemed to be spending most of their energy battling strikers at coal fields and steel mills around the country.
That sounds familiar.
This is that moment we talked about in the Valley of Fear, where people were like, oh my goodness, what are detective agencies doing? Are they here to protect the population or are they here to protect the interests of large railroads and coal mining companies? And clearly Larson is picking up on this notion that the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, with that big eye as their logo, we never sleep, we are always watching, is not watching serial killers, but is rather busting strikes.
And this is a great little reference to the Valley of Fear that we read, in the sense that we know that our, I can't even think of the gentleman's name.
Bertie Edwards.
That's right. So Bertie Edwards came from Chicago. Well, of course he could change his name. Right? He could change
Exactly.
his name.
Just like as people do, right?
Okay, of course he could join the lodge. Of course he could create a new identity. It seemed like it was ripe to do that.
Yes.
And Larson is picking up on that. We have, this is the best book that we could have possibly read right after The Valley of Fear. Good job, everyone.
Good job, Steve.
Oh, that's right. This was my choice. So we get to read one of your books next.
Now, so can I just ask a question? And I don't know what's coming next. I have not read ahead, but it strikes me that this juxtaposition of the serial killer and the architecture slash industrial energy of this world fair are being compared in some ways, contrasted, but also compared with those two men with their piercing blue eyes. And so I guess I just want to think about as we go forward, like, what's Larson going to show us about psychopaths, right? What's he going to show us about, you know, what is the commonality between major industrial forces and serial killers? I'm just guessing that that will be a question that's going to come up again.
Yes. He is definitely giving us this structure. One chapter of the industrials and one chapter of the psychopath killer, serial killer. And yes, there is certainly that juxtaposition. It's interesting that he mentions at the beginning that these two men never met as far as history records, that these two men never crossed paths. Maybe they were in the same place at the same time, but history records no meeting between these two men. But he's able to draw those juxtapositions, those differences, those similarities between these two incredibly interesting men. We'll find out as the story goes on, Pam. This is so much different from our previous discussion of Sherlock Holmes, where you were the expert and you had read every word. I've read this book and I'm not going to give you any spoilers.
Thank you, Steve.
So Pam and Steve, one of the statements that's made from Chicago many times is that the wind comes across Lake Michigan, and that's how Chicago gets the name the Windy City. And eventually that you move beyond that and you learn, oh, it must be the politicians or whatever it is. No, but this we get a definitive answer of why Chicago has a nickname the Windy City. It's 1893. There's big talk that's going to be happening, and we have a New York editor, Charles Anderson Dana, who gives the nickname the Windy City to Chicago. And this is concerning the talk of trying to make Chicago a world city, which Chicago today is a world city. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it wasn't. It was just an area looking to, you know, create its identity.
And this big World's Fair was that moment in a lot of ways that put Chicago on the map. As we have discussed, the population number made Chicago the second city in order to get this World's Fair. But it was this big event that really sparked Chicago.
All right. And we have to, I mean, just thinking about that, Chicago put a lot of effort, or the leaders of Chicago put a lot of effort to ensure that Chicago would be the second largest United States city. Chicago ended up annexing the communities outside so they could get the population, so they could just barely overtake Philadelphia as the second largest city in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't know that until I read that in the book. It's got to be super fun for you guys who actually live in the Chicago area to see this sort of history of your city.
And I've put into the notes a lot of the things that I recognized in this narrative, the street names and the locations. And I knew that you would not have the same feeling for those street names and those locations. But those are significant for me, for sure.
Absolutely.
And think of Chicago's location. It's right on Lake Michigan. The trains ended here in many ways, or changed here. So, you know, you get the livestock coming up from, say, the south or the southwest. You have shipping that's available. They could go right up through the Great Lakes and go overseas. You have the trains that could bring it east and west, so you could hit the east coast and the west coast. I mean, there's a lot of logistics that make Chicago important for where it is, but you can see right here, we're at that beginning part where they're going to fight for that opportunity.
And I love looking at the map of the United States and seeing the train tracks that all lead to Chicago. I have lived here all my life, and I've never realized that there aren't trains everywhere in every part of every other state. It's pretty fascinating to think of this being so central to all of that industry.
And don't forget, Vanderbilt ended up selling his shipping company to develop railroads. So, I mean, this is certainly, I mean, it was the latest technology of the time, and it was a way to tame the vastness of what North America.
So we do get to an ending of this part one of The Devil in the White City, and boy, is this a great ending, Pam.
You know me and my love of endings. So, now, I was fascinated and horrified that, just going up a little bit before the end, no one had forgotten how in 1885, fouled water had ignited an outbreak of cholera and typhoid that killed 10% of the city's population. Did you guys know that?
Not specifically.
Yes, exactly.
But I knew that, that water was a big problem. Sanitation was a huge problem. We get a little bit of that at the beginning of this, too.
And right. In fact, one of the, even today, the strategies for a community is, do they pull from Lake Michigan or do they pull from a well system? So where Steve lives out there, his water comes from well systems. Mm-hmm. Where I live, my water comes from Lake Michigan. There's politics involved in that. So even today, those types of challenges are still being debated.
So are you suggesting, Chip, that Chicago still has, quote, a notorious problem with sewage?
Yes.
It can.
Oh,
because,
boy.
Because beaches are closed because, mm-hmm. you know, at some level, you know, the water is taken out. I'm sorry, the sewage and stuff like that is taken out into Lake mm-hmm. Michigan.
And when it rains and the storm sewers flood basements across the city, yes, that is still a problem to this day.
So Larson brings that up before going to the end of part one. Darker forces marshaled in the smoke. Somewhere in the heart of the city, a young Irish immigrant sank still more deeply into madness. The preamble to an act that would shock the nation and destroy what Burnham dreamed would be the single greatest moment of his life. Closer at hand, a far stranger creature raised his head in equally intent anticipation. "I was born with the devil in me," he wrote. "I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing." Now, that's a very troubling juxtaposition, which, you know, is why I don't love the fact that we call Jack the Ripper's five murders the canon murders. This notion of murder as a sort of aesthetic or artistic endeavor, this comparison of murder to poetry, very, very ethically troubling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and, even for so far in what we've been introduced to, while we're not given an explicit murder, there are a lot of people missing. But we're not even given their names. They're just people right. here and there. And
just statistics.
They just happen to be around them.
Mm-hmm. So does that ending make you want to go on to part two, Pam?
Of course. I always want to go on to part two. I finish every book I start.
Wow. I cannot say that. There are plenty of half-started books on my shelf. I'll tell you that.
That's
much.
Probably a terrible thing to admit to anyone, but I do. I am a completionist when it comes to reading.
Well, I will say that if you don't like it, you don't have to complete it. There are plenty of books out there that you may like. So I okay. hope you're enjoying this book.
I hope our listeners out there are enjoying it as well. I hope that you are reading along with us. This is exciting. This is episode one of season two. So episode 124 of Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. This is the book club we've always wanted to be a part of, and I hope that you will be a part of it with us. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwiches at irregular hours. irregularhours.com. Our email is sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on all of your favorite podcatchers, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. We're out there. And I hope that you're reading along with us and getting to part two for next week. Your assignment for next week is part two of The Devil in the White City, chapters 11 through 25. That's your assignment for next Tuesday. We'll see you back here then. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive until part two. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve. Please, Pam. So.
Pam, can we come back next week?
Of course we can.
Okay, good. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflot.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
We'll see you in the future. I want to thank you again for listening to Sam. How do we end this thing?
That's your call.
How about, I don't know, Chip. Yeah, you can say the same thing. I can respond.
Does that make sense? Okay. What's happening?